Hi, this is Mrs. English, and today I'll be reading to you from Homer's Odyssey, the Richmond Latimer translation. We are now at book 19. Now, great Odysseus still remained in the hall, pondering how, with the help of Athena, he would murder the suitors. Presently, he spoke in winged words to Telemachus. "Telemachus, we must have the weapons stored away inside the high chamber, line 5, and when the suitors miss them and ask you about them, answer and beguile them with soft words, saying, 'I stored them away out of the smoke, since they are no longer like what Odysseus left behind when he went to Troyland, but are made foul with all the smoke of the fire upon them. Also, some divinity put into my head this even greater thought, that with the wine in you, you might stand up and fight and wound each other and spoil the feast and the courting, since iron all of itself works on a man and attracts him.' So Odysseus comes up with a plan. If the suitors ask, 'Why are you taking all of the weapons out of this room, out of the Megaron, the big hall?' And Telemachus will say, 'Well, they're all filthy and dirty, and what if you guys all got drunk and started killing each other?' So he spoke. And Telemachus obeyed his dear father, line 15, and summoned out Eurycleia, his nurse, and said to her, 'Come, nurse, please detain the women inside the palace while I put away my father's beautiful armor in the inner room. It is carelessly laid in the house and darkened with smoke in my father's absence, and I was a child all that time. Now I would put it away, line 20, where smoke from the fire will not reach it.' Then in turn Eurycleia, his dear nurse, said to him, 'I only hope, my child, that you will assume such foresight in taking care of the house and protecting all our possessions. But tell me, who is it will go with you and hold the light for you?' So Eurycleia is thrilled. She says, 'Wow, I hope you pay that much attention to the rest of the house and all of our possessions. The maids would have given you light, but you would not let them come out.' Then the thoughtful Telemachus said to her in answer, 'This stranger will. I will not suffer a man who feeds from our stores and does not work, even though he comes from afar off.' So he spoke, and she had no winged words for an answer. Line 30. Eurycleia barred the doors of the strong-built great hall. The two men, Odysseus and his glorious son, sprang up and began carrying helmets, shields massive in the middle, and pointed spears, and before them Pallas Athena, holding a golden lamp, gave them splendid illumination. Here they have a supernatural light provided by Athena. The nurse was worried, 'Who will hold the light for you? The maids could, but you told me to lock them all out.' And here Athena does this. Line 35. Suddenly Telemachus spoke a word to his father. 'Father, here is a great wonder that my eyes look on. Always it seems that the chamber walls, the handsome bases and roof timbers of fit and tall columns sustaining them, shine in my eyes as if a fire were blazing. There must be surely a god here, one of those who hold the high heaven.' So Telemachus notices, 'Oh, look, there's an unnatural light here.' Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered him, 'Hush, and keep it in your own mind, and do not ask questions, for this is the very way of the gods who hold Olympus. You should now go to bed, and I shall remain behind here, so that I can continue to stir up the maids, and also your mother, and she in her sorrow will question me about everything.' All right, Telemachus is supposed to go to bed. Odysseus is going to stay up, stir up the maids. He wants to find out which are the good ones, which are the bad ones, and he wants to have this private interview with Penelope. So he spoke, and Telemachus went out of the great hall to his own chamber to go to bed. If you have any type of a diagram with you of the great hall, it may be labeled as the Megaron. This would be the main hall where the hearth and the fireplace is, where the eating takes place, where the interview will take place, in the great hall, the Megaron. He went to his own chamber to go to bed, with torches to light him to his bed, where he always lay when sweet sleep came on him. Line 50. There he lay this time also, and waited for the divine dawn, while great Odysseus still remained in the hall, pondering how, with the help of Athena, he would murder the suitors. But now circumspect Penelope came down from her chamber, looking like Artemis or golden Aphrodite. They set a chair for her to sit on close by the fireplace. The chair was inlaid with ivory and silver. The craftsman Icmalius had made it, and for the feet he had joined on a footstool, all of one piece with it, A great fleece was spread out over the chair, and upon it, circumspect, Penelope took her place. So here we have Penelope's chair, which is apparently very much like a recliner chair. Her white-armed handmaidens came from the palace. They cleared and carried away a great deal of food, with the tables and goblets where the men in high spirits had been drinking, and shook the ash from the cressets, the lamps, onto the ground, then piled them again with pieces of wood to give them light and to warm them. Line 65. Again, for the second time, Melantho scolded Odysseus. Stranger, do you mean to stay here all night and bother us by poking all over the house and spying upon the women? Take yourself out of the door, you wretch, and be well satisfied with your feast, or you may be forced to get out with a torch thrown at you. Then looking darkly at her, resourceful Odysseus said to her, I wonder, why do you hold such an angry grudge against me? Is it because I am dirty and wear foul clothing upon me and go about as a public beggar? The need is on me, for such is the lot of vagabonds and men who are homeless. Line 75. I, too, was one who lived in my own house among people, prospering in wealth, and often I gave to a wanderer according to what he was and wanted when he came to me. And I had serving men by thousands, and many another good thing by which men live well and are called prosperous. Only Zeus, line 80, son of Cronos, spoiled it all. Somehow he wished to. So, woman, you should now beware lest you lose all of that glorious look with which you shine among the handmaidens. Beware of your mistress, who may grow angry with you and hate you, or Odysseus may come back. There is still time for hope there, and even if he has perished and will no longer come back, here is Telemachus, his son, by grace of Apollo, grown such a man, and in his palace none of the women will be sinful and escape, since he is a child no longer. So he spoke. And circumspect Penelope heard him, and spoke to her maidservant by name, and gave her a scolding. Always I know well what monstrous thing you are doing, you bold and shameless mother dog. You will wipe it off on your own head. You understood all this very well, because you had heard it from me, how in my halls I intended to question the stranger about my husband, since I am troubled for him incessantly. So she spoke, and addressed her housekeeper, Eurynome, bring up a chair and put a fleece on it, so that the stranger can be seated and tell me his story, and listen also to what I say. I wish to question him. Of course, the suitors are gone, the handmaidens have been locked out. She wants to question him, and she asks, she just doesn't want to be left alone with him. Line 100. So she spoke, and the servant quickly brought up and set down a well-polished chair, and laid a fleece across to cover it. On this, much enduring, great Odysseus was seated, and their discourse was begun by circumspect Penelope. Stranger, I myself first have a question to ask you. What man are you, and whence? Line 105. Where is your city, your parents? Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered her, Lady. And of course, these are the first words that Odysseus has been able to speak to Penelope for 20 years. Lady. No mortal man on the endless earth could have cause to find fault with you. Your fame, your kleos, goes up into the wide heaven. How does it go up into the wide heaven? Here we have a simile. As of some king who, as a blameless man and God-fearing and ruling as lord over many powerful people, upholds the way of good government, and the black earth yields him barley and wheat, his trees are heavy with fruit, his sheep flocks continue to bear young, the sea gives him fish because of his good leadership, and his people prosper under him. That's how, Herkleos, she's been running things perfectly for the 20 years her husband has been gone. Line 115. Question me now here in your house about all other matters, but do not ask who I am, the name of my country, for fear you may increase in my heart its burden of sorrow as I think back. I am very full of grief, and I should not sit in a house of somebody else with my lamentation and wailing. It is not good to go on mourning forever. Some one of your maids, or you yourself, might find fault with me, and say I swam in tears because my brain drowned in liquor. Circumspect Penelope said to him in answer, Stranger, all of my excellence, my erete, my beauty and figure, were ruined by the immortals at that time, when the Argives took ship for Ilion, and with them went my husband, Odysseus. If he were to come back to take me and take care of my life, then my reputation, my Kleos, would be more great and splendid. As it is now, I grieve. Such evils the god has let loose upon me. For the listener, these lines 124 through 129, are a repeat of Book 18, beginning in line 251. Word for word, line 130. For all the greatest men who have the power in the islands, in Dulichion, and Same, and in wooded Zacynthus, and all who in rocky Ithaca are holders of lordships, all these are my suitors against my will, and they wear my house out. Therefore I pay no attention to strangers, nor to suppliants, nor yet to heralds who are in the public service, but always I waste away at the inward heart, longing for Odysseus. These men try to hasten the marriage. I weave my own wiles. And of course Odysseus will be very proud of her, because she's proving herself to be worthy of him as far as being tricky. I weave my own wiles. First, the divinity put the idea of the web in my mind, to set up a great loom in my palace and set to weaving a web of threads long and fine, line 140. Then I said to them, young men, my suitors, now that the great Odysseus has perished, wait, though you are eager to marry me, until I finish this web, so that my weaving will not be useless and wasted. This is a shroud for the hero Laertes. This is Odysseus's father and Penelope's father-in-law. For when the destructive doom of death which lays men low shall take him, lest any Achaean woman in this neighborhood hold it against me that a man of many conquests lies with no sheet to wind him. So I spoke, and the proud heart in them was persuaded. Thereafter, in the daytime I would weave at my great loom, but in the night I would have torches set by and undo it. So for 3 years I was secret in my designs, convincing the Achaeans. But when the fourth year came, with the seasons returning, and the months faded, and many days had been brought to completion, then at last, through my maidservants, those careless hussies, they learned, and came upon me, and caught me, and gave me a scolding. Line 156. So, against my will and by force, I had to finish it. Now I cannot escape from this marriage. I can no longer think of another plan. My parents are urgent with me to marry. My son is vexed as they eat away our livelihood. He sees it all. He's a grown man now, most able to care for the house. And it is to whom Zeus grants this honor, this kudos. But even so, tell me who you are and the place where you come from. You are not born from any fabulous oak or a boulder. And, of course, the listener realizes this is, as some of the tales of creation are, that men would spring from rocks or something like that. Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered her, line 165. O respected wife of Odysseus, son of Laertes, you will not stop asking me about my origin. Then I will tell you, but you will give me over to sorrows even more than I have. But such is the way of it when one strays away from his own country as long as I have, wandering many cities of men and suffering hardships. Even so, I will tell you what you ask me and seek for. There is a land called Crete, in the middle of the wine-blue water, a handsome country and fertile, sea-girt, and there are many peoples in it, innumerable. There are 90 cities. Language with language mix there together. There are Achaeans, there are great-hearted Ethiocretans, there are Cydonians and Dorians in 3 divisions, and noble Pelasgians, and there is Cnossus, the great city, the palace where Minos was king for 9-year periods, and conversed with great Zeus. He was the father of my father, great-hearted Deucalion. Deucalion had 2 sons, myself and the lord Idomeneus. But Idomeneus had gone with the curved ship to Ilion along with the sons of Atreus. My glorious name was Athon, and I was the younger born, but he was the elder and better. Now, the listener realizes Penelope better had be very impressed. By claiming to be the brother of Idomeneus, Odysseus is claiming greatness, because Idomeneus was from a very good family. This means Odysseus comes from an excellent family. Line 185. It was there that I knew Odysseus and entertained him, for the force of the wind had caught him, and he was as he was making for Ilion and brought him to Crete, driving him off course past Melea. He stopped at Amnissus, where there is a cave of Eileithyia, the goddess of childbirth, in difficult harbors, and barely he had escaped from the storm wind. He went up to the town at once and asked for Idomeneus, for he said he was his hereditary friend, and respected his Zenon. But it was now the 10th or 11th day since Idomeneus had gone away along with his curved ship for Ilion, but I took him back to my own house, and well entertained him with proper hospitality, with proper Xenia. And of course this is Odysseus lying to Penelope. Perhaps he did not want to lie to Penelope. Perhaps that's why he said, "Don't ask me my name." I think that's a good possibility. So he's pretending he entertained Odysseus when Odysseus was on the way to Troy. With proper hospitality, since there was abundance in the house, and for his other companions who were his followers, I collected from the public and gave them barley and shining wine and cattle to dedicate to content their spirits. There the noble Achaeans staved 12 days, for a mighty north wind contained them, line 200, such that a man could not stand upright and walk the earth. Some harsh divinity must have roused it. But on the 13th day the wind fell, and they put forth. He knew how to say many false things that were like true sayings. And of course, this is Odysseus disguised as the beggar, telling Penelope, who is looking for any news of her husband. He remarks about Odysseus's character and says, he knew how to say many false things that were like true sayings. In other words, he knew how to lie very well. As she listened, her tears ran and her body was melted. Because, of course, now she believes this stranger. He has painted a pretty good picture of her husband Odysseus. Line 205, how did she cry and how was her body melted? As the snow melts along the high places of the mountains when the west wind has piled it there, but the south wind melts it, and as it melts the river runs full flood. It was even so that her beautiful cheeks were streaming tears as Penelope wept for her man, who was sitting there by her side. But Odysseus in his heart had pity for his wife as she mourned him, but his eyes stayed, as if they were made of horn or iron, steady under his lids. He hid his tears and deceived her. But when she had taken her pleasure of tearful lamentation, then she answered him once again and spoke and addressed him. Line 215, now, my friend, I think I will give you a test to see if it is true that there, with his godlike companions, you entertained my husband, as you say you did, in your palace. And the listener should be touched. This is really a very moving scene. Odysseus did not want her to ask who he was. He is trying to maintain his composure to save all of their lives. Their lives depend on this, and he is apparently able to do it. So these are the test questions. Line 218, tell me what sort of clothing he wore on his body, and what sort of man he was himself. There's a second question. And his companions, who followed him? There's a third question. All right, what was he wearing? What kind of man? What sort of man was he? And who followed him? Line 220. Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered her. Lady, it is difficult to tell you with so much time between, for now is the 20th year since he was in that place and went away from my country. Still, I will tell you in the way my heart imagines him. Line 225. And of course he remembers what he wore. Great Odysseus was wearing a woolen mantle of purple with two folds, but the pin to it was golden and fashioned with double sheaths, and the front part of it was artfully done. A hound held in his forepaws a dappled fawn, preying on it as it struggled, and all admired it how, although they were golden, it preyed on the fawn and strangled it, and the fawn struggled with his feet as he tried to escape him. All right, these things were all fashioned onto this pin that held his purple tunic together. This entire hunting scene was on the pin holding his tunic together. I noticed also the shining tunic that he was wearing on his body. It was like the dried-out skin of an onion, so sheer it was, and soft, and shining bright as the sun shines. Line 235. Many of the women were looking at it in admiration. And of course, what is Odysseus doing to Penelope? Who made Odysseus's clothing? Who wove the cloth? This would be Penelope herself. And she, of course, would have made his clothing and would have made certain that he was properly attired, that he looked like a king, so he could get all the respect he could. When her own husband, dressed as a beggar, says, "Many of the women were looking at it in admiration, this beautiful cloth that his mantle was made of." So if Penelope made it, this is quite the compliment to her. "But put away in your heart this other thing that I tell you. I do not know if this clothing Odysseus wore had come from his home, or if some companion gave it to him as he boarded his fast ship, or some friend abroad, since Odysseus had friendship with many men. Indeed, there were few Achaeans like him. I myself gave him a brazen sword and a double cloak of purple, a handsome thing, and a fringed tunic, and saw him off in the proper way and on his strong benched vessel. And there was a herald, a little older than he was, who went with him. I will describe to you what he looked like. He was round in the shoulders, black complexioned, woolly haired, and had the name Eurybates. Odysseus prized him above his other companions, for their thoughts were in harmony. He spoke, and still more aroused in her the passion for weeping, as she recognized the certain proofs Odysseus had given." Line 251. "But when she had taken her pleasure of tearful lamentation, then once again she spoke to him and gave him an answer. 'Stranger, while before this you had my pity, you now shall be my friend and be respected here in my palace, for I myself gave him this clothing as you describe it. I folded it in my chamber, and I too attached the shining pin to be his adornment, but I shall never welcome him home. Come back again to the beloved land of his fathers. It was on a bad day for him that Odysseus boarded his hollow ship for that evil, not to be mentioned, Ilion.' Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered her, 'O respected wife of Odysseus, son of Laertes, no longer waste your beautiful skin nor eat your heart out in lamentation for your husband. Yet I do not blame you.' Line 265. "For any woman mourns when she loses her wedded husband, with whom she has lain in love and borne children, even a lesser man than Odysseus. They say that he was like the immortals. But now give over your lamentation and mark what I tell you, for I say to you without deception, without concealment, that I have heard of the present homecoming of Odysseus. He is near in the rich land of the men of Thesprotia, and alive, and bringing many treasures back to his household. He collects this about the district. His eager companions were lost to him with his hollow ship on the wine-blue water as he left the island of Thrinakia, for Zeus and Helios hated him, since his companions killed the cattle of Helios." And here the listener realizes that Odysseus is telling her quite a bit of the truth. "So they all perished in the wash of the great sea. Only Odysseus, riding the keel, was cast ashore by the sea swell on the land of the Phaeacians, who are near the immortals, and they honored him in their hearts as if he had been a divinity, and gave him much, and they themselves were willing to carry him home without harm. So Odysseus would have been home a long time before this, but in his mind he thought it more profitable to go about and visit much country, collecting possessions." Line 285. "For Odysseus knew profitable ways beyond all other men who are mortal. No other man could rival him at it. So Phaedon, king of the Thesprotians, told me the story, and he swore to me in my presence, as he poured out a libation in his house, that the ship was drawn down to the sea, and the crew were ready to carry Odysseus back again to his own dear country. But before that, he sent me off, for a ship of Thesprotian men happened then to be sailing for Dulichion, rich in wheat fields, and he showed me all the possessions gathered in by Odysseus. These would feed a succession of heirs to the 10th generation. So many treasures are stored for him in the house of the great king. But he said Odysseus had gone to Dodona to listen to the will of Zeus out of the holy deep-leaved oak tree. For how could he come back to the rich countryside of Ithaca in secret or openly, having been by now long absent?" Now, Odysseus says, "The king told me this himself. He showed me all of the things. I didn't see Odysseus again, but I saw the treasures, and the king told me Odysseus went to Dodona." This is like going to Delphi, but it's a different site for an oracle. And, of course, at Delphi, they sit over the crack on the tripod, and the Pythian priestess inhales the natural gas fumes and gives her ambiguous reply. At Dodona, they listen to the rustling of the oak leaves. And he's gone there to listen to the rustling of the oak leaves to see how he should come back to Ithaca. Should he come back secretly, or should he come back openly, because he's been gone a long time? At this time, I would like my students to consider whether Penelope has any idea that this man is Odysseus or not. Much ink has been spilled on this topic, and many books have addressed this subject. Does Penelope realize perhaps this is Odysseus? Is this Odysseus's safe way of revealing himself to her, but telling her to be quiet, that he has a plan of forcing her to realize that he could not come back openly? Consider both of these options in your mind as you listen to the rest of this story, and think of what she would say because of each circumstance. What would she say if she thought it might be Odysseus come back in secret? What would she say if she thought he was just a beggar stranger? Continuing in the text at line 300. So he is safe, as you see, and is now coming back. He is very close at hand and will not for long be far from his country and his own people. I will swear you a firm oath to this. Zeus be my witness, first of the gods, and the table of friendship, and the hearth of blameless Odysseus, to which I come as a suppliant. All these things are being accomplished in the way I tell them. Sometime within this very year, Odysseus will be here, either at the waning of the moon or at its onset. Circumspect Penelope said to him in answer, If only this word, stranger and guest, were brought to fulfillment, soon you would be aware of my love and many gifts given by me, so any man who met you would call you blessed. But here is the way I think in my mind, and the way it will happen. Odysseus will never come home again, nor will you be given conveyance, for there are none to give orders left in the household, such as Odysseus was among men, if he ever existed, for receiving respected strangers and sending them off on their journeys. But come, handmaidens, give him a wash and spread a couch for him here, with bedding and coverlets and with shining blankets, so that he can keep warm as he waits for dawn of the golden throne. And early tomorrow you shall give him a bath, anoint him, so that he can sit in the hall beside Telemachus, and expect to dine there. And it will be the worse for any of those men who inflicts heart-wasting annoyance on him. He will accomplish nothing here for all his terrible spite. For how, my friend, will you learn if I in any way surpass the rest of women in mind and thoughtful good sense? And the word here for good sense is metis, the same word that gets applied to Odysseus as an adjective repeatedly. He has said, he's heard, her reputation is the best among women, and so she's saying, how can you know I'm better among women unless I prove it to you? So she says, So how, my friend, line 325, will you learn if I in any way surpass the rest of women in mind and thoughtful good sense in Metis, if you must attend, badly dressed and unwashed, the feasting in the palace? Human beings live for only a short time, and when a man is harsh himself and his mind knows harsh thoughts, all men pray that sufferings will befall him hereafter while he lives, and when he is dead all men make fun of him. But when a man is blameless himself and his thoughts are blameless, the friends he has entertained carry his fame, his kleos, widely to all mankind, and many are they who call him excellent. Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered her, O respected wife of Odysseus, son of Laertes, coverlets and shining rugs have been hateful to me ever since that time when I left the snowy mountains of Crete behind me and went away on my long oared vessel. I will lie now as I have lain before through the sleepless nights, for many have been the nights when on an unpleasant couch I lay and awaited the throned dawn in her splendor. Nor is there any desire in my heart for foot basins to wash my feet, nor shall any woman lay hold of my feet, not one of those such as do your work for you in your palace, but not unless there is some aged and virtuous woman whose heart has had to endure as many troubles as mine has. If such a one were to touch my feet, I should not be angry. And the listener needs to consider two circumstances. One is that Odysseus does not want a young maid to wash his feet because they've been the ones scorning him, and perhaps they'll be the ones assigned to do it. However, if he does not want to be recognized, the natural thing for him to agree to is to have one of the young women, who certainly was not there when he was living at home before, for him to specifically ask for an old woman who is virtuous to wash his feet is really to ask to be recognized. Then in turn, circumspect Penelope answered, line 350, "Dear friend, never before has there been any man so thoughtful among those friends from far places who have come to my palace as guests. So thoughtful and so well considered is everything you say. I do have one old woman whose thoughts are prudent, who was nurse to that unhappy man and took good care of him. She took him up in her hands when first his mother had borne him, and she shall wash your feet, though she has little strength for it. Come then, circumspect Eurycleia, rise up and wash the feet of one who is the same age as your master. Odysseus must by this time have just such hands and feet as you do, for in misfortune mortal men grow old more suddenly." So he spoke, and the old woman covered her face in her hands and shed hot tears, and spoke to him, you may as well cross those out, says one of my commentaries, and spoke in words of compassion. And here is poor Eurycleia, who nursed and raised up Odysseus, and she's speaking as into emptiness, but she's speaking as though she's speaking to Odysseus, with her hands covering her face. "How helpless I am to help you, my child. Surely Zeus hated you beyond all other men, though you had a godly spirit, for no man among mortals ever has burned so many thigh pieces to Zeus, who delights in the thunder, nor given so many choice and grand sacrifices as you prayed you might come to a sleek old age and raise your glorious son to manhood. Now for you alone he took away your day of homecoming. So it must be for him also that in the houses of far-off friends, whose famous homes he enters, the women tease him, and now these bad girls are all teasing you, stranger, and it is to avoid their abuse and shameful speaking you will not let them wash your feet. But circumspect Penelope, daughter of Icarius, told me to do it, nor am I unwilling. So I shall wash your feet, both for the sake of Penelope, but also for yourself, since the heart is stirred within me by sorrows. But come, attend to me in the word I tell you. There have been many hard-traveling strangers who have come here, but I say I have never seen one as like as you are to Odysseus." Okay, you sure look like Odysseus. No one else coming here has looked like Odysseus, both as to your feet and voice and appearance. Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered her, "So all say, old dame, who with their eyes have looked on the two of us. They say we two are very similar, each to each, as you yourself have noticed and tell me." So he spoke, line 386, and the old woman took up the shining basin that she used for foot washing, and poured in it a great deal of water, the cold first, and then she added the hot to it. And now Odysseus was sitting close to the fire, but suddenly turned to the dark side. So Odysseus tries to hide his face in the shadows because Eurycleia is going to wash his feet. For another foot recognition scene, you can check back in book 4, where Helen recognized Odysseus by foot washing, back in book 4, line 244. So he turns his face to the shade, or to the dark side, so she won't see his face. Line 390. For presently he thought in his heart that, as she handled him, she might be aware of his scar, and all his story might come out. She came up close and washed her lord, and at once she recognized that scar. All right, now we leave the story, and we are going to hear the entire story of how Odysseus got the scar. She recognized that scar, which once the boar and his white tusk had inflicted on him when he went to Parnassus, to Autolycus and his children. This was his mother's noble father, line 395, who surpassed all men in thievery and the art of the oath, and the god Hermes himself had endowed him, for he had pleased him by burning the thigh bones of lambs and kids, and the god freely gave him his favor. Autolycus came once to the rich country of Ithaca, and found that a child there was newly born to his daughter, and, as he finished his evening meal, Eurycleia laid him upon his very knees, and spoke him a word and named him. Autolycus, now find yourself that name you will bestow on your own child's dear child, for you have prayed much to have him. Line 405. Then Autolycus spoke to her and gave her an answer. My son-in-law and daughter, give him the name I tell you, since I have come to this place distasteful to many, women and men alike on the prospering earth, so let him be given the name Odysseus, that is, distasteful. Then, when he grows up and comes to the great house of his mother's line and Parnassus, where there are possessions that are called mine, I will give him freely of these to make him happy and send him back to you. So this is the story of how Odysseus got his scar. First of all, we have the story of his birth, his relationship to Autolycus, how he got his name, and that Autolycus said, when he grows up, have him come back here and I'll give him all these gifts. This was why Odysseus came. This is how he came and then got the scar, so that he would give him glorious presents. Autolycus and the sons of Autolycus greeted him with clasping of hands and words of endearment, and Amphithea, his mother's mother, embraced Odysseus and kissed his head and kissed, too, his beautiful shining eyes. Autolycus gave his glorious sons the order to make ready the dinner, and they listened to his urging. Presently they brought in an ox, a male, 5 years old. They skinned the victim and put it in order and butchered the carcass and cut the meat expertly into small pieces and spitted the morsels and roasted all carefully and shared out the portions. So for the whole length of the day until the sun's setting they feasted, nor was any man's hunger denied a fair portion. But when the sun went down and the sacred darkness came over, then they went to their beds and took the blessing of slumber. But when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, they went out on their way to the hunt, the dogs and the people, the sons of Autolycus, line 430, and with them noble Odysseus went. They came to the steep mountain, mantled in forest, Parnassus, and soon they were up in the windy folds. At this time the sun had just begun to strike on the ploughlands, rising out of the quiet water and the deep stream of the ocean. The hunters came to a wooded valley, and on ahead of them ran the dogs, casting about for the tracks. And behind them the sons of Autolycus, and with them noble Odysseus went close behind the hounds, shaking his spear, far shadowing. Now there, inside that thick of a bush, was the lair of a great boar. Neither could the force of wet-blown winds penetrate here, nor could the shining sun ever strike through with his rays, nor yet could the rain pass all the way through it, so close together it grew, with a fall of leaves drifted in dense profusion. The thudding made by the feet of men and dogs came to him as they closed on him in the hunt, and against them he from his wood lair bristled strongly his nape, and with fire from his eyes glaring stood up to face them close. The first of all was Odysseus, who swept in, holding high in his heavy hand the long spear, and furious to stab. But too quick for him, the boar drove over the knee and with his tusk gashed much of the flesh, tearing sideways, and did not reach the bone of the man. Now Odysseus stabbed at him and hit him in the right shoulder, and straight on through him past the point of the shining spearhead. He screamed and dropped in the dust, and the life spirit flitted from him, of course from the boar. And so Odysseus, now we have another heroic deed of Odysseus, and he was just a young man when he did this. Not only did he strike the boar, but held on to it, who knows what the boar was doing, and drove it on through and killed him. Line 455. The dear sons of Autolycus were busy to tend him, and understandingly they bound up the wound of stately godlike Odysseus, and singing incantations over it stayed the black blood, and soon came back to the house of their loving father. Then Autolycus and the sons of Autolycus, healing him well and giving him shining presents, sent him speedily back rejoicing to his own beloved country in Ithaca, and there his father and queenly mother were glad in his homecoming, and asked about all that had happened, and how he came by his wound, and he told well his story, how in the hunt the boar with his white tusk had wounded him, as he went up to Parnassus with the sons of Autolycus. That is the end, line 466, is the end of the boar wound story. Now we heard how he got it, and we know that back line 392, at once she recognized that scar with which the boar with his white tusk had inflicted on him. And now we are back to the story. Line 4, 6, 7. The old woman, holding him in the palms of her hands, say, holding his foot, recognized this scar as she handled it. She let his foot go, so that his leg, which was in the basin, fell free, and the bronze echoed. The basin tipped over on one side. Okay, she's shocked. And the water spilled out on the floor. Pain and joy seized her at once, and both eyes filled with tears, and the springing voice was held within her. She took the beard of Odysseus in her hands and spoke to him. "Then, dear child, you are really Odysseus. I did not know you before, not until I had touched my lord all over." She spoke, and turned her eyes toward Penelope, wishing to indicate to her beloved husband's presence. But Penelope was not able to look that way or perceive him, since Athena turned aside her perception. Of course, that was quite handy. Just as Eurycleia the nurse recognizes Odysseus and says, "Oh my goodness!" and she's going to tell Penelope, Penelope has looked away and Athena has put kind of a cloud over her, and Penelope doesn't catch on. Odysseus groped for her and took her by the throat with his right hand, while with the other he pulled her closer to him and said to her, "Nurse, why are you trying to kill me? You yourself suckled me at your own breast, and now at last, after suffering much, I've come in the 20th year back to my own country. But now that you have learned who I am, and the god put it into your mind, hush! Let nobody else in the palace know of it. For so I tell you straight out, and it will be a thing accomplished. If you do, and by my hands the god beats down the arrogant suitors, nurse of mine though you are, I will not spare you when I kill the rest of the serving maids in my palace." All right, Odysseus, his only thought is, of course, to save them all. And Eurycleia, his old nurse, he hasn't seen her for 20 years. This may seem kind of cruel, but he has to get her to understand that she must not show she recognizes him, or they're all dead. Then, in turn, circumspect Eurycleia said to him, "My child, what sort of word escaped your teeth's barrier? Oh my goodness, what did you just say? You know what strength is steady in me, and it will not give way at all, but I shall hold as stubborn as stone or iron, and put away in your heart this other thing that I tell you. If by your hands the god beats down the arrogant suitors, then I will give you the list of those women who in your palace have been mutinous against you, and tell you which are innocent." Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered her. Line 500. "Nurse, why should you tell me of them? There's no need to. I myself will properly study each and learn of each. Leave it to the gods, and keep the story in silence." So he spoke, and the old woman went back through the hall to fetch another basin, for all the water that had been there formerly was spilled. When she had washed him and anointed him with oil, Odysseus drew his chair closer to the fire, trying to keep warm, but hid the scar under his ragged clothing. Circumspect Penelope then began their talking. "Friend, I will stay here and talk to you just for a little." Line 5, 10. "To be sure, it will soon be the time for sweet rest, for one delicious sleep takes hold of, although he may be sorrowful. The divinity gave me grief beyond measure. The day times I indulge in lamentation, mourning as I look to my own tasks and those of my maids in the palace. But after the night comes and sleep has taken all others, I lie on my bed, and the sharp anxieties swarming thick and fast on my beating heart torment my sorrowing self." And how is Penelope tormented at night? What is it like? "As when Pandareus's daughter, the greenwood nightingale, perching in the deep of the forest foliage, sings out her lovely song when springtime has just begun, she, varying the manifold strains of her voice, pours out the melody, mourning Itylus, son of the Lord Zephys, her own beloved child, whom she once killed with the bronze when the madness was on her. So is my mind divided, and starts one way and then another. And before we discuss the two ways, what shall she do? The story of Pandareus's daughter, mentioned here in line 518. Pandareus was a king of Crete. He had Aiden, who married Zephys, who had Itylus. Itylus, who was mentioned here, son of the Lord Zephys, her own beloved child, in line 522. Aiden's sister-in-law was Niobe. You remember her story. Niobe had many children. Aiden was jealous, and she went in the dark of night. She was going to kill Niobe's oldest child out of jealousy. And of course, what did she do? she accidentally killed her own only child. And of course, because she lamented and lamented, Zeus decided she was better off if he just turned her into a nightingale, and that way she could always lament. That gives a little more meaning to this long metaphor, long simile, when Pandareus' daughter, the nightingale, sings out. So when she laments at night, it's just like this poor nightingale who killed her only child. So my mind is divided, line 524, and starts one way, then another. Shall I stay here by my son and keep all in order? My property, my serving maid, and my great high-roofed house? Keep faith with my husband's bed and regard the voice of the people? Or, this is a second thought, go away at last with the best of all those Achaeans who court me here in the palace with endless gifts to win me. Okay, what should I do? Line 530. My son, while he was still a child and thoughtless, would not let me marry and leave the house of my husband. But now that he's grown a tall man and come to maturity's measure, he even prays me to go home out of the palace, fretting over the property which the Achaean men are devouring. But come, listen to a dream of mine. And here Penelope is going to ask Odysseus to interpret her dream, and interpret it for me. I have 20 geese here about the house, and they feed on grains of wheat from the water trough. I love to watch them, but a great eagle with crooked beak came down from the mountain and broke the necks of them all and killed them. So the whole 20 lay dead about the house, but he soared high in the bright air. Then I began to weep, that was in my dream, and cried out aloud, and around me gathered the fair-haired Achaean women as I cried out sorrowing for my geese killed by the eagle. But he came back again and perched on the jut of the gabled roof. Line 545. He now had a human voice and spoke aloud to me. Do not fear, O daughter of far-famed Icarius. This is no dream, but a blessing real as day. You will see it done. The geese are the suitors, and I, the eagle, have been a bird of portent. But now I am your own husband. Come home, and I shall inflict shameless destruction on all the suitors. So he spoke, and then the honey-sweet sleep released me. And I looked about and saw the geese in my palace feeding on their grains of wheat from the water trough, just as they had been. Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered her. Line 555. Lady, it is impossible to read this dream and avoid it by turning another way, since Odysseus himself has told you its meaning, how it will end. The suitor's doom is evident for one and all. Not one will avoid his death and destruction. Circumspect Penelope said to him in answer, line 560, My friend, dreams are things hard to interpret, hopeless to puzzle out, and people find out that not all of them end in anything. There are two gates through which the insubstantial dreams issue. One pair of gates is made of horn, and one of ivory. Those of the dreams which issue through the gate of sawn ivory, these are deceptive dreams. Their message is never accomplished. But those that come into the open through the gates of the polished horn accomplish the truth for any mortal who sees them. These two dream gates will be picked up, the idea of this will be picked up again by Virgil, and he's going to use this in his Aeneid. We will see this in the Aeneid in Book 6. If you want to take a look, it's in line 893 in the Aeneid, Book 6, line 893. These two dream gates. Back to Odysseus, line 568. I do not think that this strange dream that I had came to me through this gate. My son and I would be glad if it did so. And put away in your heart this other thing that I tell you. This dawn will be a day of evil name, which will take me away from the house of Odysseus. For now, I will set up a contest. Now, before I tell my listener about the contest, I want to ask you, why would Penelope set up a contest now, when she has every reason to believe, or at least to hope, that Odysseus is going to return? Why not wait? And I'll ask my listener, does Penelope know or suspect that this beggar is Odysseus undercover? Remember, she is as clever as he is. How could Penelope provide Odysseus with some type of a weapon He has made it clear to her he's going to kill all the suitors, that Odysseus will kill all the suitors. If she knows this is Odysseus, she knows his plan now. How could she aid him in that plan? And this is a possibility. She could make sure he gets a weapon that she knows he can handle well. And it's also possible that this is circumstantial. All right, what kind of contest is she going to set up? Line 573. I'm going to set up a contest. Those axes which in his palace he used to set up in order so that 12 in all they stood in a row, like timbers to hold a ship, he would stand far off and send a shaft through them. Now I will set these up as a contest before my suitors, and the one who takes the bow in his hands, strings it with the greatest ease, and sends an arrow clean through all the 12 axes, shall be the one I will go away with, forsaking this house where I was a bride, a lovely place and full of good living. To think that even in my dreams, I shall never forget it. Very interesting. Why would Penelope think up a contest for the suitors? That means whoever wins, she has to go off with them. Very interesting. Then resourceful Odysseus spoke in turn and answered her, "Oh, respected wife of Odysseus, son of Laertes, do not put off this contest in your house any longer." Line 585. Before these people can handle the well-wrought bow and manage to hook the string and bend it and send a shaft through the iron, Odysseus of the many designs will be back here with you. So Odysseus says as the beggar, "My, what a good idea. Yes, do it." Circumspect Penelope said to him in answer, "If, my friend, you were willing to sit by me in my palace and entertain me, no sleep would be drifted over my eyelids." So Penelope is saying, "I sure wish we could just sit up all night and talk." Line 591. But it is in no way possible for people forever to go without sleep, and the immortals have given to mortals each his own due share all over the grain-giving cornland. So I shall now go back again to my upper chamber and lie on my bed, which is made a sorrowful thing now. All was disordered with the tears I have wept ever since Odysseus went away to that evil, not to be mentioned, Ilion. There I must lie, but you can sleep here in the house, either bedding down on the floor, or they can make a bed for you. Line 600. So she spoke and went back up to her shining chamber, not alone, since others, her women, went to attend her. She went back to the upper story with her attendant women and wept for Odysseus, her beloved husband, until gray-eyed Athena cast sweet slumber over her eyelids. And thus ends Book 19.